Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and hotep. Welcome to the Care to Read Room. You've got your Omienka 7 live coming to you straight from my studio. I'd like to welcome each and every one of you and say Habari Ghani to my new friends and say what's up to those old friends. Come in and have a seat. Thank you for joining us on this segment, ladies and gentlemen, and happy Black History Month to each and every one of you. As you know, we have been lifting up our voices and singing a new song. We have been talking about raising up girls and where are girls rising. We have been focusing in on also letting you know that our men should be rising simultaneously with us. We are not going to be raising a flag going forward without our men. Of course, we want to look at those male-dominated professions and look at how are women faring in those professions. How are they doing? And across the nation in the diaspora, we have women that are matriculating in every profession. However, in some of those third world countries, we have women who are not allowed to go to school. And some of those child marriages where they are forced into marriages. Now, we have been advocating for those women and speaking out on behalf of them. As you know, we are sponsoring and also featuring the film Where's Girls Rising, and that will be featured out in Maryville, Indiana, out at the Star Theater. We're asking you to purchase your tickets to support that effort. Now, 10 by 10 is supporting all of the women in that effort all across the nation, and that is a male-dominated organization, mind you. And therefore, we are looking at trying to bring this to the forefront so we can give those women an opportunity to have support. And many of them are in litigations, and they're in court right now as we speak, trying to solidify their rights in those child marriages. And that's one of the reasons we focus in on law this month, ladies and gentlemen. As you know, we've been talking to lawyers throughout this month as well as potential candidates for the law degree. Today we have a professor that's joining us from Loyola University. Her name is Zelda Harris. She is a professor of law at Loyola University. She comes back to Chicago by way of Arizona. She is a native of Chicago. However, she's been away in Arizona for over 14 years practicing in the area of family law and domestic violence. She's one of the first women that's been appointed to the Advocacy Center, which is a phenomenal thing, and I wanted to point that out. She has matriculated up the ladder in her profession. We want to welcome her, and we want her to give us as much information as she can on the types of things that the bureaucracy, the added stresses that go along with the territory of a woman being in a male-dominated field. And we're going to be talking to her about her profession and some of the challenges and some of the success stories that women have had in the field of law. And right now we're going to go in and welcome her and say hello. Then we'll go straight to a station identification. So just bear with us, ladies and gentlemen, as I say hello to my guest. Hello, Zelda.
Hello. Good afternoon.
thank you so much for joining us, and we will be putting you right in the atmosphere in 1 second. We have a little house cleaning to do, so stay tuned. We'll meet you in the atmosphere, all right?
Okay.
All right, stay tuned. Thank you so much, ladies and gentlemen, for joining us. And Zelda, we do a dedication in our room. We are African-centered, and we make no apologies for that. We're trying to make sure that our African-American families understand that there must be some type of procedure in teaching the traditional heritage. And one of the things is we do a libation, and we'll continue with that libation, and we'll do the dedication. And we also acknowledge our ancestors here because we know it's their shoulders that we stand on. So if you have any outstanding heroes and sheroes, Zelda, that you would like to mention, please go right ahead and mention their name. We're going to start off by pouring our libation to the east and the west and then to the south and north. And then we call on all of those great heroes and sheroes because we know that a lot of those men and women like Thurgood Marshall, he worked from the basement of a schoolhouse learning and gathering his information on law. It was because of his outstanding heroes and sheroes that he made it to the profession of law and in spite of himself. So join us as we do our libation. And this is something that we urge you in the audience to also participate and do. We pour libations to Oladulamare, who is the highest person that resides over the universe, and we say Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour libations to the north, and we say Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour libations to the south, and we say Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour libations to the east, Ashe.
Ashe.
And we pour libations to the west, and say Ashe.
Ashe.
Now, if you have any outstanding heroes or sheroes, and if they are coming through the middle passage and they're not yet here yet, if they're still on the other side of the Red Sea, we are beckoning that they will come and join us and be by our side to reconnect the circle. So I'd like to call on Sheikh S. Diop, who wrote many books, to collaborate with our efforts to talk about our history and our heritage. We do have a heritage, and most of all, we must realize we have a culture. And I say, Ashe. I call on the name of Dr. Martin Luther King and Sweet Coretta King, and I say, Ashe. I call on Nina Simone. Will she be a witness today? And I say, Ashe. I like to call on the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. I say, Ashe. I like to call on Madam C.J. Walker. Will you be a witness today? I say, Ashe. Thurgood Marshall, come and be a witness. Ashe. The Honorable Moses, will you be a witness? And we call her Moses, but we know her name is Harriet Tubman. Will you be a witness today? And if there's any names that you would like to call out, Zelda, you can call them out now at this time of your heroes and your mighty heroic heroes.
Well, I'd just like to give honor and respect to my mother, Myrtle Johnson, and my grandmother, Rosa Harris.
Ashe, Ashe. So be it, so let it be done. And we thank you for this opportunity for joining us today on this occasion for Black History Month. Thank you so much. Mrs. Zelda here, once again, ladies and gentlemen, is a law professor at Loyola University, and she's agreed to come and join us today in honor of the outstanding women who are matriculating and rising up the ladder. She has been chosen as an advocate, one of the first women in the Advocate Center. And I'm going to have her tell us a little bit more about the responsibilities of an advocate and also tell us how did you decide to go into law and what were some of the strenuous things that you had to matriculate through before you were able to enter in the field and what is it like to be in the field of a law professor. Dr. Harris, you have the atmosphere.
Thank you. I'll first start with the current position at Loyola. the center that I direct is responsible for training law students who are going to be trial attorneys. So they could be going into court to try cases in criminal court or civil court. So these are oftentimes attorneys who become public defenders or prosecutors, or you may see them in personal injury cases or family law cases. So they are not the ones who are doing the research. They're the ones actually taking the case to trial and making those arguments before the court and the jury. And so they need training beforehand. And myself and my staff, we're responsible for making sure that they get appropriate training in law school before they get out and engage in practice. And so I came to the position after practicing law myself, as you said in that nice introduction. I was in Arizona for 14 years practicing domestic violence litigation for primarily representing women who were victims of domestic abuse in court, and family law. And my practice was also involved with a law school training program. So law students assisted me in those programs too. So we provided legal representation to those who could not otherwise afford to hire an attorney. And so I come here back to Chicago, very fortunate. The person that was in the position before me had been had retired. He had been in the position for 30 years. I knew Professor Carey quite well. He was a mentor of mine, and I was very fortunate to be able to take his spot when he retired.
Well, let me ask you a question, Zelda. Now, what do you perceive to be one of the most trying or challenging part of the actual job responsibility that you are charged with carrying out?
Well, I think everyone is probably familiar with the media attention that's been directed toward law schools, that the cost of law schools is rising every year, every semester. Some of our law students are coming out of law school owing over $140,000 worth of debt, but the job market is depressed. And so there's no question that we cannot find positions for everyone that needs a job, or we cannot find perhaps the job that they want or at the pay that they need in order to repay the loans. And so although we are engaged in the training of law students, there's no guarantee they're going to be able to get a job as a litigation attorney once they graduate from law school. And so that impacts, you know, everyone regardless of race, gender, you know, socioeconomic income. That's a big factor.
Well, you know, I had been watching the same statistical documentation that you're referring to, and it's interesting because there are actually deans of law schools who are talking about this rather candidly, because they are very, very much concerned. Some of them also are leaving their professions because they fear that they might have to take a job in pro bono offices, and that is probably the area and why I thought it would be necessary to invite you here, because we've been talking about pro se and also those legal aid offices that are cropping up all over the nation, where you're finding that they're having the micro centers, and a large portion of these law students are finding employment in these agencies that are looking at low-income families who can't afford to pay the fees for lawyers, but they can come in and pay on a sliding scale. So that is one of the areas that we've been talking about, because most people feel they can't afford law, so they go without the attorney representation. And sometimes they don't realize that they really can afford that lawyer if they go in to talk with those pro bono offices. Can you speak a little bit about where are the pro bono officers, well, lawyers these days, and where can they find the pro bono help?
Well, I can speak generally. I cannot speak too specifically to Chicago because, as you mentioned, I'm just getting back here, although it is my understanding that the Legal Assistance Foundation of Chicago is still very much in operation and is probably the main point of access for most folks who are unable to afford an attorney. So Legal Assistance Foundation, I would definitely direct people to. But I guess, you know, I'm involved in this effort now because, again, the law students who are coming out of school realize that, yes, they could probably develop a practice, so maybe they'll go into business with just one or two of them and trying to serve clients who can pay at a sliding scale fee. So that's definitely a model. But those students need help, right? I mean, they're just coming directly out of law school. They would need a lot of support, and they would need a lot of alumni attorneys to come back and give them some guidance, because they're not only just trying to practice law as new attorneys, but trying to run a business. So that's it's a challenging venture, but for the ambitious student, they are definitely doing that, or the ambitious graduate. As far as pro bono agencies, you know, that's a difficult spot because many of the pro bono agencies in the past, anyway, have received government funding. And as we know, government funding is drying up. So there's increasing reliance on private streams of income, but that also brings its own challenges in terms of what people want to fund, and oftentimes private donations for lawyer organizations are difficult to come by. So we've seen in our law school at Loyola that the law students actually are having difficulty getting into those pro bono agencies because they too don't have the money to hire.
Now, do you foresee that there's going to be any type of grassroots organization that might be forming from these new baby boomers who are now coming out with their credentials, that they may form a collaboration and do something like a micro center that would start off getting those new law students involved with getting their hands wet and doing cases so they could get that experience?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I do think that's a model that's emerging across the country at certain law schools. I mean, it's not universal, but I do think that Kent Law School here in Chicago is trying to experiment with something like that in terms of giving space to some of its law students to do the very thing that you're talking about.
I see. Now, can you elaborate a little bit on some of the things that's going on with the high school, middle schoolers, and this pre-college attempt to prepare students to go into the field, and the Saturday classes that they offer for those young people in the area of street law? Can you tell us a little bit more about what's that all about?
Well, again, I can speak kind of generally. Professor Mary Bird is actually the person at Loyola that is the director of that program. But overall, law schools understand that there's been underrepresentation of certain groups, right? So persons of color in particular, Black, Latino, specifically. And so over the last, I'd say, 10 to 15 years, there have been efforts to make a pipeline from high school to law school, you know, to get the kids ready, to get them interested, and to inform and educate them as to what they need to do to go to law school. So Loyola has a program that does outreach to various schools in Chicago where there's been underrepresentation. And so, you know, the idea is to get those students informed, educated, and, you know, invested. I know that I participated in a mock trial program with some of those students a few weeks ago, and in chatting with the students, many of them are indeed interested in coming to law school, and they're going to, you know, participate in the six-week program and get as much information as they can, because they will then do what they need to do to get through undergraduate school and take the necessary entrance exams to get into law school.
You know, Judge, I wanted to call you Judge because I saw you in the position of a judge, so if you don't mind me calling you Judge every now and then.
Okay.
You did that role real good as a judge. anyway, Zelda, are you aware of the fact that that program is not just indicative to Chicago, that University of Indiana, Bloomington, I understand that they also have a Saturday pre-college program for students as well?
Yeah, that would make sense. We had one at Arizona, too. So those are pretty typical at law schools. I mean, a lot of it depends on what the law school mission is and what their resources are. At some schools, they're run more by the law student groups themselves, like the Black Law Students Association, without having any law school administrative oversight. But, you know, if it's a school that has some resources, they can definitely put some additional resources and administrators with it.
And, you know, what I'm seeing, and just like anything, when it first starts off, that when there is just a few people in that profession, the actual cost could be risen to any height because people need that service. But as the profession grows and becomes oversaturated, that there might be an opportunity to look at that profession and say, hey, now this is affordable, so we are going to have to reexamine what fees are. And in reexamining the fees, then that would open up an opportunity to possibly cut down on the high fees and give some of the people, the citizens, a chance to access the law and be able to utilize the services, by at the same time allowing the institutions to possibly cut down on the fees, because anytime you talk about $100,000, $150,000 that you're in debt to loans, then that becomes astronomical. And economically, when you look at being cost, you know, trying to make it cost affordable, you have to make sure that that the actual ends will represent the means. So if you're spending more to obtain the degree without actually being able to justify yourself in acquiring a position in that field, it won't be economically lucrative to make decisions like that. But it will be something that can go back and say, hey, we need to change some tuition fees here because we can't justify these positions once they graduate. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. And it just so happens that you mentioned some of the law school deans are commenting in that fashion, and our law school dean is one of them, David Yellen, and he's been very vocal. You know, we can't sustain these increased fees. You know, we've kind of hit the ceiling, so to speak, with that. And, you know, there has to be change. Even if it doesn't come from within the law schools themselves, you know, the public will certainly demand it. But there are opportunities. I mean, I can say that I've been very pleased in coming to Loyola and that they have a record number of African-American law students throughout the law school. It's still low in comparison to the population here in Chicago, but when you look at other law schools, I think you have to be impressed. Most law schools, in terms of African-American law students, have percentages in the single digits, and Loyola is, you know, close to 20%, I think, or it's double digits at some number. So it's a critical mass of students that can get that have a voice and can get some things done. And so I'm sure these young people that have come to school, knowing that the debt looms large, are probably thinking, how are they going to make a difference? How are they going to make a change in spite of having this debt when they come out? So it's not deterring folks necessarily from going.
Professor Harris, how do you perceive the students looking at utilizing their ability to become a pro se candidates, and do you advocate for pro se for those who cannot afford the law?
Well, again, I'll have to kind of comment on that based on my most recent practice experience, which was in Arizona, and my affiliation with the law school there. The law students were engaged in helping to create pro se litigation forms that were easier for the public to use than what was currently available through the courthouse. And so think about small claims actions or uncontested divorces or, small disputes that people can file the litigation on their own if they just have the tools to do that. And so law students can be instrumental and getting that information into the hands of the public. The cautionary note is that there's still laws on the books that say that people without a law license can't hold themselves out to be lawyers. And so law students have to be very careful to not be practicing law without a license. But in terms of giving forms to people that are in plain English that people can easily understand and use, law students can play a great role in that. Law students can play a good role in helping people find the law and figure out Chicago here. The court system is so huge that law students could play a very good role in helping people just figure out where to go to file the right documents and to get the litigation started. And so, again, I mean, there's definitely been a lot of press on the fact that people who may not go to law school because the cost is so high may open up businesses that are just short of being a lawyer, right? So, again, think of paraprofessionals, paralegals, and all that they can do to help the pro se litigant. That's going to become an emerging business more so than it is even now, right? Because people can't, afford the lawyers.
Now, is there any way that you could possibly see the lawyers collaborating with the efforts of those paraprofessionals in the profession to make it a team approach?
Yeah, that's hard. That's possibly. Paralegals obviously work in law firms and with hand-in-hand with lawyers all of the time. You usually, if you're going to see lawyers not acting as lawyers but acting as business persons who are in business with paralegals, they won't be practicing law. I guess that's the short answer. They'll be running the business and helping to coordinate it, but it wouldn't be that's the line. Either you're going to hold yourself out as the lawyer or not, you know.
I see. Now, Zelda, tell me a little bit about the natural law and also the black codes and the black laws. Are they still on the book? Because African American, they're talking a lot about how are some of these laws that were on the book during slavery still existing, and they're camouflaged, but at the same time, you have a number of people that are interested in these black laws and understanding are they still on the books, and how do you get to understanding that these laws are not on the books, but from what perspective would you say that they are and are still on the books?
I guess I'd have to know more specifically which laws you're referencing. It may be something that's beyond family law and beyond domestic violence. If you're talking about like voting laws or some of
these laws that during slavery time that they were on the books and they were used primarily, I think at that particular time they were put on the books right after. We had the Great Depression where slaves were coming out of slavery, and some of the laws were still in the book, and some young people in street law, they ask these questions all the time. What about the black laws, and are they still on the books, and how can we determine if they're not on the books? And then you have natural laws, and you have so many young people that when they take street law courses, they ask a number of questions about what happened during slavery when these laws were supposed to have come off the books.
Right. Well, I think, again, if I understand your question, that's really going to be a state-by-state analysis, whether or not those particular laws are still on the books, so to speak. And so, if I understand the laws that you're talking about, I think you're talking about laws that were primarily in the southern states and south regions. So I'm not sure what...
Like the Jim Crow laws that were...
Right, I mean, those are... So, I mean, that would be a state-by-state analysis and not a federal law question, right? So you would have to look to see if Alabama or Mississippi, for example, still have a particular black law on the books. But it's also a question of enforcement, and it's also it's probably more, in my mind, more of a political question and making sure that the representatives in the particular jurisdiction move those issues to the forefront to get laws off the books that are not constitutional. So lawyers can definitely help in that effort if there has to be litigation filed over them, but certainly having the political will to figure out, you know, what are these laws that are still on the books that need to be addressed.
Well, thank you so very much, Professor Harris. I just enjoyed the interview with you. I'd like to also say that I know you've tried a lot of different cases, but can you think of any particular phenomenal case that you've ever worked on in a collaborative a group of family law lawyers or litigation that made history?
Well, you know, I'll say this. You know, every case that I've worked on has made history for that personal family, and that's the thing about family law. You know, they may not have most family law cases do not wind their way into the U.S. Supreme Court, but they have lasting impressions for the children and families involved, and so. The cases that I have been involved in have been personally very trying, but also very rewarding to really get to know the families. I have had the honor of working intimately with families in Arizona, in Chicago. I've practiced in Philadelphia also, and in downstate Illinois. And so it's an honor, you know, to be able to know families and know communities in that way.
Well, thank you so very much. And ladies and gentlemen, our chat rooms are open. However, if you'd like to chat and write anything in the chat box, you can. We just listened to Professor Zelda Harris. She is from Loyola University. We want to thank her so very much. And you are welcome to come back, Professor Harris, at any time. If you'd like to elaborate on how girls are rising, what would you say some of the challenges are for women to be in this male-dominant profession?
I'd still say, you know, isolation is pretty great, although women compromise at more than 50% of law school attendees. People in law school, usually more than 50% are women. So the law school experience is usually pretty supportive, but once you get out into practice, and especially those who go into litigation because of the demands on your time, there's a lot of drop-off, and so you end up being very, isolated. And it's, you know, I've had men as mentors, as I've mentioned, but, it just makes it that much more difficult to connect with the professionals around you and be able to, find kind of natural alliances. So that is still a challenge.
So there's a challenge out there for you, ladies and gentlemen. You want to break those barriers down. Professor Harris has told us there are some challenges, and that means that as we come into this male-dominant profession, we can challenge the system on those issues. And I think law is going to be changing, Professor Harris, for the better, for the actual constituents who need law. It's going to be changing, and those barriers with the cost is going to be also challenged. And also the tuition will be challenged, and that will be a great thing. So it will be open up so that a large percentage of African Americans will be able to afford the law, and they won't have to try to piecemeal under pro se, and they can get, you know, fine lawyers to represent them. And we'd like to thank you so much, Professor Harris,
sure,
and invite you back at any given time. And we are working with Girls Rising here in this room, so anything that you would like to say or do on behalf of supporting the women in the profession, just let us know, because this is coming up for the month of March. We'll be doing a great number of things for women during that month, not to mention that we won't be carrying the men along, but we're trying to accentuate some of the women and how they're rising. So we'd like to thank you, and please come back and join us. Ladies and gentlemen, we're all out of time, and we like to say that we are winners. Thank you, Professor.
Say yes!
Thank you so very much for joining us. And we as women are moving on up.